Stay tuned for Living Writers coming up right about now.
Afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Laura Hulfin Thomas here in the studio. Laura, welcome to Living Writers. Thanks for coming down to the studio today.
Thank you so much for having me, T. It's wonderful to see you, and it's wonderful to be on your show. Thank you.
Well, welcome back. This is our second radio conversation together. The first was States of Motion, and we were talking off air, and you said it was before the pandemic.
It was. It was in that other life that we had before the pandemic, and it was my first book with Wayne State University Press, and you and I had a great conversation about it.
Oh, and it's a collection of short stories.
It was a short story collection, and actually a couple of the stories in that collection became this novel, so it's very relevant that I was to talk about that and that I was, you know, here a few years ago, and now the novel is here, born of that short story collection.
And I hope, let's talk a little bit about that too. But first, thanks for also choosing today's songs and starting us off with some Talking Heads. Was there a reason you picked that song, Laura?
Well, I love the song. And I love the Talking Heads. And I, you know, that's one of the songs I played a lot when I was writing this novel, just this concept of, you know, you may ask yourself, how do I work this? And how did I get here? And, you know, you think you're making your choices, and Leah and Paul have made good choices in their lives to sort of move past childhood trauma. They got married, they, you know, they have stable jobs. And yet when, you know, the chips start to fall and they find themselves struggling, they're asking themselves, wait a minute, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife.
Right. Yeah, and how did it come to be?
Exactly.
And you move in The Meaning of Fear, your debut novel. You move between the past and the present. We start in the past, move to the present. And there's this strong connection between the characters' lives where you get to see how the things are connected. Because they do start trying to figure out, how did it come to be?
Exactly. How did I get here? And how do I work this?
Yeah. Well, before we get to talking about it even more, I want to take a chance here just to read the short bio. Laura Hulfin Thomas's deeply human, emotional storytelling explores blue and white collars, lovers and spouses, mothers and children, and the unique Michigan places that shape these relationships. Her novels, stories, and essays reveal the complexities of home, work, and the Midwestern landscape. Laura heads the undergraduate creative writing program at the University of Michigan's Residential College. Her first book, States of Motion, was a finalist for a Forward Reviews Indie Award. Laura, welcome back to Living Writers.
Thank you.
So good to see you. So maybe we could start with the note that you said that this book, The Meaning of Fear, this novel, grew from short stories. And there were two in the States of Motion. And was there another one that had been published elsewhere too? Like, was it a trio of stories, or how?
Yes. Yeah, so
what was that like? How did it come to be?
Right. Yeah. So in States of Motion, there were actually two stories that bookended the collection about a character who would become Leah in this novel. She was a behavioral researcher studying the fear response and then struggling to cope with her husband's recovery from a traumatic brain injury caused by a random violent attack. Very dark subject matter. But, you know, it was, I was curious how a scientist who had also had a history of trauma and had mastered, she thought, her history of trauma and kind of come to terms with it, and how a scientist and someone who had a well-ordered life would then react to an unexpected attack that brings back memories of her own. And then there was another story, totally unrelated in the collection, about a cop whose own childhood trauma and the pressures of his job are causing him to have marital issues. And so how the past was surfacing for him. And, you know, after the story, the collection was published, you know, usually when I finish a story and it's published and I let it go, I don't really think about it too much anymore. But Leah and who became Leah and Paul, I think it was Emily and Dan, were their names in the collections. You know, I just couldn't let them go. Just, you know, I kept thinking about them and thinking about them and writing a little bit more of their stories. And then I was talking with a friend. We were at a bounce house place with our kids. You know, they were still young enough back then to be bouncing around. And, you know, we were just talking about how our friendship had started with kind of sharing some, you know, stories of our own about some childhood experiences. And I said, you know what, we hadn't known each other very well, and we were sort of sharing our secrets. And, you know, that just really seemed to me very unusual that we would click so quickly. And she says, oh, she said, you know, my friend, it didn't surprise me at all. I feel like people in pain tend to find each other. And that blew me away. And then our kids are bouncing around. And I thought, you know, who became Lee and Paul, they're like my kids who, you know, need to play together. You know, they need to bounce around in a novel. They need to meet. They have this, they're very wildly different people, wildly different temperaments, and yet they have this thing in common.
They need to meet.
Yes. So they did in this novel.
And so has that happened to you before, Laura, that there's been characters from, because you've been writing short stories for, well since you were a wee lass.
A wee lass. That's very true. Yes, right.
Yes, you're right.
I don't have anything funny to say to that except that is very true. I started when I was very young.
And has this happened to you before where there are some characters that just don't let you go? Or is that the reason that The Meaning of Fear came to be, because it's your debut novel, as I've said. So congratulations
again.
Thank
you. Very
cool. And it's a different form working in this longer, the novel form. So were Leah and Paul or Emily and Dan, were they the first ones that just didn't let you go and demanded this larger space to be part of, to inhabit a larger world with you?
They were the first ones, you know, for whatever reason. I just did not feel like their stories were finished in the short stories. And the stories in States of Motion about Emily in particular were very long to begin with. And I still hadn't felt like that had gone far enough. And I did not feel like the Dan story had gone far enough at all. And so once I got this revelation that the way to work on these people and the way to work on their situations and their characters and understand where they're coming from and why they wouldn't let me go was to bring them together and see what happened and work my way through a novel. And so that process ended up being messier. I know novel writing is always messy, but the way I went about mining their relationship, putting them in different situations and seeing what they would do ended up making for a very messy composition process, which I was actually grateful for in the end, because even though it made my life kind of hard to revise and sort of figure out this dynamic that they had going, like how could these people be so drawn to each other when they have every reason to mistrust each other? Leah's very distrustful of the police because of some childhood experiences there. And Paul doesn't really trust anyone, you know, really, neither of them trust themselves or their own instincts. So why am I thinking these folks belong together? And the process of exploring that, I'm glad it was messy because I think that their lives are messy. And that was just meaningful to me to be in their psyches and to just really get into their stories and explore them in a way that was not organized. you know, that maybe mimic their own experience of their lives.
And then to stick with it, to find the revisions, to find your way through it. Could you give like an overview, like a for folks, like just to frame like the meaning of fear? Like the title itself even scares me, Laura. Like I keep in my head, I was even trying to think of it as the meaning of war, the meaning. And then I was like, no, that's the meaning of fear. It's a strong title. Could you tell us like what the novel is a bit? Give us a framework.
Yes. So The Meaning of Fear, that title came to me pretty late in the process. I really didn't have a very good working title. I had just titled it, I'd actually, for my own purposes, titled it Centennial Farms, which is the subdivision where Leah lives, that has been built on Paul's old family land. So Paul's family owned a centennial farm, and it's set during the recession of 2008. So prior to the recession, his mother had sold off the land to a developer, and half of the subdivision where Leah is living, which is called Centennial Farms, and Paul hates it that the subdivision's streets are named things like, you know, Corn Silk Drive, you know, and Cobb Road or whatever, and he just thinks this is just the dumbest thing ever. And also, it's his beat, you know, this is a rural township, so he's with the sheriff's office, and this is, you know, where he now, you know, patrols and does his job. And it just, you know, rubs him the wrong way that this place used to be the family farm where he would, you know, tend the fields with his dad. And now there's all these bougie rich folks, you know, who are now, you know, living on his land and, you know, sort of causing trouble for him. So that was the original name of the novel. And as I drilled down into Leah's job is studying the fear response, and I ended up structuring the novel according to the stages of her research. And you know, I'm going to mess it up, but the three, it's the fear, fear conditioning, fear. Fear, that she instills fear, she conditions them to fear, and then she extinguishes fear. It's fear extinction is the last one. Sorry to mess up my own novel structure there.
No,
But
I looked back at you in fear.
I can't remember my own novel. And that is the meaning of fear, that you won't remember what to say about your own novel. But in any case, once I started centering the novel on her exploration and the science of fear that she's trying to get at, that changed the meaning of the novel for me, because I realized that what we think of as fear and what Leah is researching as fear may have different layers to it than what we understand fear to be. And I'll just leave it there so that I'm not spoiling, you know, some of the revelations that she makes. So then The Meaning of Fear became a very obvious title to me once I realized what I was really writing about.
Oh, that's, I love that. Let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Laura Holthan-Thomas is here. The novel on the table with us is The Meaning of Fear, out with Regal House Publishing. We've been talking about States of Motion, out with Wayne State University Press. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We've got Reverend Andrew behind the glass. We'll be back. back. If you're just tuning in, so glad you did. Today on the program, Laura Thomas, Michigan's own Laura Thomas, is here in the studio. The Meaning of Fear, her debut novel, out with Regal House Publishing. Laura, so how long, like we talked about the bouncy houses and thinking about like these two, you know, but how long did it take for The Meaning of Fear to come to be? Like, how long have you been working on this with the, and thanks for starting to talk to us about the process and how it was messy as well. And it didn't scare you off that it was messy. You felt like it was meant to be.
I think to write a good novel, it's got to be messy and it's got to be a little bit scary, and you've got to kind of lose your way in order to find it. That's, you know, I think for literary themes and challenging themes, this book has a lot of challenging subject matter. I think that's the way for it to feel authentic and not manipulative or, taking advantage of the characters, but really respecting their experience requires a lot of patience. It just requires letting them do their thing and letting them reveal things to you, and not imposing the writer's sort of what I want out of it. I want to know what they want out of their lives and the story. As far as how long it took, that's a hard question to answer, because I would put it aside and work on other things. And as you know, we both teach, and we give a lot to our students. And so it's not a linear sort of writing process, I think, when you're also balancing it with teaching and family life and other duties. So I know that I finished the first draft before the pandemic, which is now quite a bit in the rearview mirror. But after the pandemic, when I was getting rejections from publishers and kind of working through, you know, if I got any kind of feedback, I would really think about it. And I revised it several times. I restructured it a couple of times. It had opened with Leah in the lab originally, and I decided to go ahead and put her childhood story first, just so the readers could really see Leah and Paul as kids, and also see the intersection point, you know, how they meet briefly in childhood, mm-hmm. so that the reader knows that there is this connection. Leah and Paul don't recognize each other as adults, but I want the reader to know that they did have this brief meeting one time when they were kids. And after I restructured it and did it according to Leah's research into the fear response, I think that then the revisions started to fall into place a little bit more neatly. And I remember before submitting it to Regal House, which would have been now 2 or 3 years ago, because it takes 2 years for the publishing process, I had just spent the summer revising The Meaning of Fear one more time, and then I submitted it to Janie Royal at Regal House, and she said yes, and I was real grateful to that. She said she loved it, and I was just real happy to hear that.
Well, shout out to Janie and Regal House.
They've been a fabulous publisher, yes.
And also, like, and to the perseverance, like, that you had, like, also believing in the novel.
Yes, I did believe in these characters. I believed in the novel. I knew that it was not going to be easy to find the right home because of the subject matter being challenging. Deep dives into trauma, looking at, not looking away. It's not for every reader, and that's okay, because the readers who need to find it, I hope, will find it and get solace from it. And it needs the right publisher. It needs the right editor. It needs, you know, it needs a team that understands what the novel is out in the world to do.
So we've been talking about it, like, well, near it. So maybe we should talk to, like, this challenging subject matter. Because even the structural change you made with taking us first to Leah's childhood rather than opening with her as an adult in a lab, in a place where you can see she's established. It opens in 1998, I think.
1982.
Oh, 1982. 82. Good
yes,
Lord,
yes,
because, my numbers. Okay,
well, no,
sorry.
You actually are pretty close in terms of their ages, but the main action is the 2008 recession. So if you back up from there, 1982 would have them be teenagers.
Oh,
yes.
And so
yes.
So we're in 1982, and she's young. She's an early teen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, about 13 she would be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the challenging material in this is that she has been sexually abused.
She has been sexually assaulted by a friend of her father's, and she has been unable to tell her parents what happened, but she also thinks that her parents magically know, because when we're kids, we have that kind of magical thinking. And so she's struggling with not only the after effects of an assault, but also struggling with the fact that she thinks her parents know, but they're still friends with this guy. So that leads her to, you know, obviously quite a bit of upset and not knowing where to put her feelings and not knowing who to trust. She ends up forming a close friendship with another girl who's new to the school and is sort of odd in her own right, and they form a real bond that lasts.
This is Dinah.
This is Dinah. Yes. Yes. Dinah kind of comes on the scene and is sort of the classic frenemy. She loves Leah and Leah loves her, and yet they're very different. They have different values as they grow up. Leah ends up being a researcher with using animal subjects, and in her view, the good that does to cure human illness, and the fact that, you know, current technologies make animals the most the best subjects, if I can put it that way, to effect cures. She believes in that, and Dinah does not. Dinah ends up being an animal rights activist, and then they have some back and forth about their different values, and Dinah has a major betrayal of the friendship involving, you know, her activism. So,
was it hard to start with 1982, and in this moment where we write almost within the first paragraphs, we know that this is happening. What is it like for you to write through the write trauma, but also from a vulnerable young person's perspective?
That was difficult. This book is not autobiographical, and however, Leah is a composite of several women that I have known or do know, and I guess the way I would answer that question is I feel very strongly about the experiences that the women I know have experienced and wanted to capture that. And I also recognized that the way to capture it was to let Leah lead the way. And she was very, she's not in denial about what happened, but the way she copes with it is to withdraw and to observe herself, observe, you know, these ants. The opening scene involves her observing how ants, you know, have a biological instinct to just go around harm. And so that's the first glimmer of hope for her that, okay, I don't know what's safe and I don't know where to go. And I feel on the outs with other people. I'm not like other people anymore. I don't know whether I did anything to cause this thing, so I feel guilty. But then when she sees that you can reroute, you know, that there's a biological way that a forward, you know, for someone who's been harmed or a creature that's been harmed, then she starts dedicating herself to science and is able to put that, you know, harm, feeling like the harm done to her made her a good person and made her into the kind of person who can do good for others. And that made sense. I felt like I could write that comfortably. That made sense to me. It was harder to write what happens to her as an adult in a funny way, because when it all falls apart, she you know, I didn't know how she was going to cope with that. Yeah.
And it's interesting that you say that, Laura, but you're, as the writer, you know, many people would say, well, that's the story that you're telling. You know that.
Only after it's done. I'm always telling my students, you know, they'll be midway through a story. We teach one-on-one in tutorials, so they're often in the residential college where I teach. And they'll often hand in progress on stories, and we'll go over, you know, my feedback, and we'll kind of talk about it. But I always say to them, you know, do some editing as you go, but you really need to end this story. You need to know what happens, and then you can go back and you know, then craft the story knowing how it's going to end. But I don't know. I know there are authors who outline. I'm not one of those. I know there are authors who probably do know their endings or have endings in mind. I think the vast majority of students I work with, and certainly my own process, which I think is a good one, is not to know, maybe have an idea, but not to be certain. I think certainty and fiction do not go together.
Because what's the effect of that, do you find, as like writing it or even reading it as a reader?
You know, I think you then, as the writer, can fall into the trap of not being true to a character's true experience. You might want them to be on a certain path to make your point rather than to capture their experience. You may want to bring certain themes or ideas that are yours to the page. And I feel like that's the realm of essay writing as opposed to fiction.
And you're also an essayist.
Yes. But even then, I often don't know what I'm writing about until I figure it out with the essay form, too, which, again, works for me, not for everybody. And I'm talking about fiction that challenges the reader, not so much your romance genre or genre writing where there may be a template that folks do follow, that readers love and want you to follow. I'm a big fan of murder mysteries. I want my murder mysteries to follow the formula and do creative things within them. But for literary fiction, challenging fiction, fiction that is really character-driven and character-centered, I just think you better not be too sure of where you're going as a writer until you reach the end and you just think, yeah, that's where the characters have landed.
What surprised you the most, or which character surprised you the most in the meaning of fear?
That's a good question. The character that surprised me the most was probably there's a minor character named Luke. And this is, Paul has he's having marital problems with his wife, Julia, and she's hooked up with this much younger man and is dating him, even though Paul and Julia are not yet divorced. And Luke was your classic breakout character. I thought nothing of him in the early drafts. He was just like, yeah, you know, she's dating this guy. He's not going anywhere. And he, you know, as I kept drafting and kept getting into, you know, what Luke was doing in the story, he's the one who surprised me the most.
Let's take a short break. Thanks, Laura. Today on the program, Laura Thomas is here. Her debut novel on the table with us, The Meaning of Fear, out with Regal House Publishing. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Cries of pity. Siege guns have been pounding through the night. It took a day to build a city. We walked through its streets in the afternoon. As I returned across the fields I'd known, I recognized the walls that I'd once made. Had to stop in my tracks for fear. Thank you.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today in the studio, I'm so happy to be sitting across from Laura Thomas. We've got the Rev behind the glass, and thanks to JAV for pulling the songs today. So we have them at the ready, as Laura's also DJing today.
That was the funnest part. Yeah, well, no, the funnest part is talking to you. I'm before the broadcast. The funnest part of the prep was picking the songs. Thank you.
Well, you mentioned before we came on air that you do a song of the day for your classes too, Laura. What's that?
Like, yeah, so we open every... I just started doing this years ago. We had a new sound system in the classroom, and honestly, I just wanted to like crank out a tune. And so it was actually a Talking Heads song. It wasn't Once in a Lifetime. It was, I can't remember now what it was. Anyway, I just turned it up to see how loud it would go, and the students really liked it, and it sparked some good conversations about the text we were examining. And I thought, we can have this fun every day. So many years later, I still do Song of the Day, and we end up then tying the Song of the Day to the text that we're talking about. And it's fabulous. But when I have authors come to visit and I tell them, oh, you can pick a song, that's the scariest part for them. They're like, well, what do you mean to pick a song? And which song should I pick?
Classroom.
Yes, when they come to their class, yes. And well, what do you mean then the students tie in to what I'm going to read, and how do they do that? And, the stakes are very high for Song of the Day. So
oh my gosh.
Our playlists are everything.
Who knew though? Meanwhile, you're like, we just have fun with this. And they're like, do the students choose the songs too, Laura, or do you usually bring the songs in?
So I do the songs for the material that I'm teaching them, and then when we're workshopping, they get to take turns picking their song of the day, and so it can be something that ties into their story. But since we have to guess what the tie-in is, sometimes I just say, you can just pick a song that you love and make us do some tie-in to your story. Anything goes. But it's just so, music is just such a good way to, to relax, to get into the flow. And, and like I said, the playlist is everything. People love their playlists,
I think in the first few pages of The Meaning of Fear, like Jack and Diane is mentioned.
Yes.
Too. So you have music kind of playing a role.
That was such a big tune in 1982. And it felt very Midwestern to me. I can't remember if the song is actually set in the Midwest. It's just two American kids doing the best they can. Is that the line? And I don't know. But that just feels sort of Rust Belt to me. I don't know why.
Right. I mean, we'll have to ask John Cougar Mellencamp. John Mellencamp.
Yeah, let's have him on.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, before we get too far back in the conversation, Laura, would you mind reading some from The Meaning of Fear so listeners can get a sense of the prose and the novel?
Sure, I'd love to. And thanks for asking me to do that. So I'm going, since we had been talking about the role of animal research for Leah and the fact that she... I think many people would think of that as a morally ambiguous career, but she feels like the greater good is being served, through her research and through using live animal subjects. So when the novel opens, she has learned that there's going to be a deer call in her neighborhood to trim the herd for health purposes, which, of course, you could argue is also being for the greater good, but a lot of people might, like Leah, kind of object to or feel weird, morally ambiguous, about, about killing deer in their neighborhood. The novel is really testing her moral boundaries around the treatment of animals for a greater human good. So I'm going to read... I'm going to pick up a memory that she has. This occurs during a scene where she's come home to see a strange man in her yard, and he is setting up for sharpshooters to be in trees kind of near her house. And so she's sort of dealing with this situation and wondering, what the heck? And so I'm going to just read how she learned about the call. And this memory, too, is of her first glimpse of Paul Rilke. She doesn't know who he is yet and doesn't know how important he will become to her, but this is their first point of connection. When she'd learned from the neighborhood association that, come late fall, sharpshooters would fill her subdivision's trees, Leah had driven straight to the county office to complain. The information sheet the brisk young woman behind the desk handed her, in response to your inquiry, explained the call as a painless euthanasia. The herd reduction was divided into phases. During the first phase, sharpshooters would target does from safe and supervised bait sites. The maintenance phase that followed lasted a week. Incentives were set for qualified volunteers to harvest at least one doe. More substantial cash rewards were given for the most does culled at the close of the hunt. The culling of bucks, while not prohibited, was discouraged. Controlling the female segment of the population is critically necessary, the sheet noted. A forlorn graphic of a hand-rendered ink outline of a deer, head cocked in caution, a front hoof raised tentatively as if to flee, was printed in the handout's bottom margin. Behind the brisk young county clerk, two cops hunched over worn laminate desks strewn with carbon paper, as if the computer sitting blank and idle at another empty desk was a last-ditch resource for true emergencies. The good-looking one with a sculpted build and silky dark hair had glanced up at her briefly when she'd first entered. He checked her out, dismissed her unimpressive figure cocooned in a loose cable sweater and old jeans, her plain brown hair, her anxious expression. The overweight one, inexplicably wearing teardrop reflective shades indoors, hadn't looked at her at all. As she'd stood staring first at the handout and then at the clerk's smiling firewall of Midwestern distance, the overweight cop dropped his pen tiredly, as if he'd encountered a question he couldn't answer, leaned back in his chair, and tilted his lenses at her. Not overweight, the shift of his body revealed, just big, all muscle. The shades beamed at her in the room's harsh fluorescence. He might have been looking straight at her, or past her dismissively, as the good-looking officer had done. The shades were a masculine parody of her mother's favorite costume, the gigantic 60-era sunglasses she had used to accessorize her suffering. The lenses reoriented back to the paperwork. For a heavy man, the cop's features, at least what she could detect behind the glasses, were delicate. Rosebud lips, a soft rounded chin, uncombed hair the color of a beer bottle. He sat upon the form as if something in their glancing exchange had answered the question that had stymied him. How he could see anything at all through the dark mirrors shading his eyes stymied her. Her aversion to cops rose in her then. The promise of security that was only for show. She balled her fist. The handout crinkled. This same big cop would show up on her stoop a few weeks later to write up the report after their house was robbed. He would meet her questions about recovering their stuff with condescension, as if she were stupid to wonder if stolen goods might reasonably be sought or even found. The clerk asked whether, after studying the information sheet, she had any more questions. "Yes, I have a question," Leah said. "This all seems very dangerous." The clerk waited patiently for Leah to realize she'd made a statement, not a question. Leah crossed her arms. "I have young children." Which was another statement. The shades tilted her way again. The call took place with close cooperation from the sheriff's office, she was told. And she was also told that there had never been an adverse event, and there were community forums where she could provide feedback on the impact in her neighborhood, and if she had any other questions, which she didn't, then all right, have a great day. Leah had left wondering about the young woman's definition of adverse events. And I'll leave it there.
Thanks. Thanks, Laura. So that feels also very, in a way, very Ann Arbor.
Indeed. Yes. So the main action is in a township very close to Ann Arbor, and Leah's lab is at the University of Michigan, which in 2008 was undergoing a lot of financial stress. The war on terror was at its height. And of course, with the recession, lots of, you know, funding was drying up. And so, yes, she's definitely in an Ann Arbor type place. The township is fictional, but Ann Arbor is named in the novel, and it is not fictional. Yes.
And so much about the deer cull. Like, I feel like if you live in Ann Arbor, everybody knows about the deer cull.
Indeed.
And most people have a position on it.
Most people have very strong feelings about it on both sides, right? So some would think of it as just terrible. And why are we shooting these deer? Or, you know, sometimes there's the poisoning of the bait sites or whatever the, you know, whatever the means. But then there are some who talk about overpopulation not being good for the deer and the spread of disease and. So
I do love those moments where it's like you can tell, like, this had to be part of the book in some, well, it didn't have to be, but I shouldn't say that. I've read other books set in Ann Arbor and there isn't a deer call mentioned in them. I don't know why that has to
well,
be.
Well, this
the
is
new
outside
thing.
Of Ann Arbor. We don't have the deer call in the city limits. Or do we? I don't know if we do.
I think
there's
do.
Parks where they yes. will close in the winter. They will conduct calls in the wintertime at parks. Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, maybe we'll see. I'm moving away from the deer call material already. But I noticed a thread when you read this part out loud that, and I wonder if this is something that you as a writer consciously do because as a way to also connect the past and the present for the characters, because Leah in this moment is at the police station, but she thinks of the sunglasses as like a shield and connects them back to her mother. Mm-hmm. And her mother is in the opening pages of the 1982 scene that the novel begins with, because she's in having a deep depression,
yes.
and is wearing the Jackie O sunglasses there.
Yes. To hide the fact that she's depressed and weepy. And this is something that Leah has, it's a memory that she has of her mom and her suffering. And I think Leah, as an adult, when she says accessorize her suffering, there's a real air of judgment there. Again, this misunderstanding that she thought that her parents knew what had happened to her, which she realized they didn't, you know, so as an adult, but still feeling that she was adrift as a kid, that this thing happened to her, that she couldn't or didn't share with them, and these essential misunderstandings. So there's a little bit of a judgy thing. And then there was also a misunderstanding when she did try to tell Officer Friendly in school. Officer Friendly didn't understand what was going on, and the teacher kind of steps in and says, well, there are problems at home, and that's why, you know, Leah is saying these things. And so, again, there's the frustration Leah is carrying from childhood about the miscommunications along the way. And so, as folks do, she's externalizing those misunderstandings by, you know, I guess she knows better. She's an adult. She knows better than to blame Officer Friendly and knows better than to blame her mom for not fixing what happened to her, but the small child in her is like, you know, parents are supposed to help us be safe, and Officer Friendly should have understood what I was saying. And so she sees, you know, Paul, who she will learn is Paul later on, and, you know, just has a real visceral reaction to seeing him in those shades and, you know, just looking past her, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Laura, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Laura Thomas is here. You just got to hear an excerpt from her debut novel out with Regal House Publishing, The Meaning of Fear. And the cover is so dark as well. Could you describe it a little bit, Laura, before we go to break?
Let's do our break because I actually have a little story about the cover.
Well, then we will. Yes. We'll do the break. And on the other side of it, ooh, it's also like, it's a teaser. Stay tuned.
For the cover
on the other side
of The Meaning
of
Fear.
Yes, The Meaning of Fear with Laura Thomas. Okay, I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Why does my heart feel so blank? Why does my soul feel so blank? Why does my heart my soul feels so bad? Why does my heart
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time because Laura Thomas is here today on Living Writers, her debut novel on the table with us, The Meaning of Fear, just out this March 24th.
March 24th was the book birthday.
Yes. So yes. Happy. It's happy belated.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's so exciting. And did you have one of your launches? Have you had the book? I feel like you were at Nicola's, like Schuller's Books and Literati.
No,
already
or no. So I had two launches. My husband joked it was launch west and east.
Okay.
I had the first launch at Serendipity Books on the 24th in Chelsea.
Oh, wonderful!
Which was lovely. Beautiful bookstore. Shout out to Michelle and her team. Cookies and wine and great conversation. I was there with my good friend Brian Cox, a journalist who interviewed me. I've known him since high school. He's fabulous, a playwright, journalist. Colleagues and friends and family came. It was beautiful. And then a week later, we had a launch at Literati for the U of M community, and it was great to see family there and friends and also colleagues and students and some former students, some of whom have moved back to Ann Arbor, and I wasn't aware that I said, are you just in town for this? And they're like, no, we're back, and we wanted to see you read from your new novel. So it was just really fabulous to have two great events to celebrate this.
Like a real communities, both.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. And two great bookstores. You know, let's buy all our books from our local bookstores, please.
Yes.
They'll order anything that isn't in stock. And, you know, let's just spend all our time at these bookstores.
They're good places.
They are.
Good third spaces.
Yes.
So Laura, we were, like a bit earlier, we started to talk about Leah's friendship or frenemy with Dinah.
Yes.
Oh, but the cover. Oh my
gosh. Can't tease our listeners anymore.
Thank you so much for keeping me honest, Laura. Yes. So we've got Regal House Publishing. You said it was wonderful experience.
Yes.
Working with them.
Yes.
So tell us about the cover and how it came about.
Yes. So I don't know if you want to describe the cover for listeners because they can't see this cover.
Would you mind?
Or I can do it.
Because you're intimately.
Well, a little too intimately. So the cover, there is it's a very Michigan cover. I think we've all either had nightmares or actual encounters with images like this, but it's this gigantic buck with empty eyes, and it's against a background of a night sky because Paul Rilke, the cop, takes the night shift. And on the back, you see the little rumpus of the buck. So the buck appears to be in extremis. You know, it appears to be in pain. And there's, you know, either a tongue or a little bit of blood and a little bit of maybe blood on the ear. So it's a very visceral cover. And, you know, my poor and wonderful husband has been living with this, we call him Bucky, and he's been living with Bucky in extremis in many rooms of our home. And, you know, thank you, Ron, for putting up with and living with Bucky all these months through the advanced reader copies and the novel. However, I promised a story, and of course there is one. So famously, authors have very little control over the covers. We don't design our covers. We don't pick them. So Regal House is one of those publishers who asked for ideas, and so I submitted some ideas of, you know, covers that I thought would fit. But they have final say over the covers, and none of my ideas were a buck with his, you know, snout to the sky with these, you know, distressed eyes. With his antlers piercing the word fear. That was not on my list. And that's what Regal House gave me. So I was actually at work when they emailed me and said that the cover, you know, was done. And so I opened my email in my office and I looked at this image and I was just shocked because I got the cover reveal in February a year ago. But in November, the previous November, I had been visiting relatives in Grand Rapids with my son, who's in his 20s, and he lives in California now, and he was back home visiting. And on the way home, we, going 70 miles an hour on 27, we hit a deer, and it was a buck, and it was huge. and it looked exactly like this cover in the windshield. We could see the eye, we could see the antlers, we could see the snout. It literally came out of nowhere. It was just in the windshield like a hologram. I still remember to this day, and we hit it. And it was, you know, it was a bad accident. We were fine, and we managed to, you know, get to a rest area. It destroyed the car. But I thought, you know, it is immortalized. This, I, you know, sent the cover to my son. I said, how did Regal House know that this had happened to us? So every Michigander has their I hit a deer story, and ours is now on the cover of my novel. And I don't know how the publisher knew that this would is part of my story too.
Yes. And thank goodness, since it wasn't one of the ones that you sent to them, that you also felt like a connection to it and that it connected to the feel of this novel too.
It's a visceral cover, and it is a very, and it evokes a lot of visceral feelings in anyone who's, you know, sort of had a bad encounter on the road with wildlife.
Oh, well, Laura, you know what? I wanted to also ask you about your book trailer, because I noticed that you have, like, from your website, I was able to get easily to your YouTube hosted book trailer.
Yes.
What was the could you talk to us about that? Because there's deer in that, but they're alive.
Yes.
So don't worry, folks.
Yes, exactly.
And there's a bunny.
Yes.
Which has, like, eerie. Anyway, but yeah. Laura, why the book trailer?
Yeah, so I wanted a book trailer so that that potential readers could get a feeling of the novel, but, you know, without giving too much away. And I hired, I did not do this trailer myself. I hired someone to do it for me, and they did a fabulous job with the wildlife. And so you do see more, you see fawns, and fawns do play a role in the novel, and then you see this bunny, and I feel like in the trailer the bunny is captured perfectly because it's a white bunny, but it's a little muddy, you know, so it's, you know, a cute bunny, but also not, you know, not Mr. Fluffy, not the Easter Bunny, and so I feel like, and then the trailer itself is, you know, gesturing or signaling to some of the themes in a nuanced way, with images of the young girl and everything. So things are, you know, it's kind of, the trailer is not like David Lynch, but it's Lynchian in that you see, you know, sort of this wildlife, but something seems off and you wonder, okay, what's under the surface of, you know, all of this stuff that's going on and all of this wildlife and, you know, what's the, you know, what could be the dark side? What's going to be revealed?
So is that, what did you send them things to work with and ask them to use images, like the folks that made it?
You know, I sent them, I highlighted passages in the novel that I thought I wanted to have represented. I am not visual. I almost failed art class in high school and chemistry. Those are my two worst subjects. And so I sent them the text and said, you know, let's see what, and they did a perfect job.
And at the end of it, because they include quotes from other, like, people that have blurbed the book as well.
Yes.
But at the very end, it ends with one of the quotes from the book. Those committed to cruel acts preserved their zeal and devotion while those out to stop them burned out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that is a quote from Dinah, and we were going to talk maybe about the female friendship at the heart of the novel, too. So, yes, that is a quote from Dinah. We get her point of view a little bit in the novel. It's kind of blended with Leah's in a creative way. As a matter of fact, some editors were saying, you know, it's too blended. We can't tell which is which. And that's one of the critiques I decided to not take in revisions. I wanted them to feel like, you know, if you put Dinah and Leah together, maybe you'd have a whole person in a way. I felt like they clash and yet they fit together, as all sort of challenging female friendships do. But Dinah, early in the novel, has this sort of view of Leah as kind of clueless about the harm she's causing to animals. And really, if you're going to be a moral person, in Dinah's view, you don't harm anything. You know, there are other ways to conduct this research, and it's your job to find them. And she keeps coming back to Leah to try to convince her to take a different stance towards her research and her life. And at one point, Leah says, you know, I'm just a lab middle manager. You know, I'm nobody. You know, why do you keep bringing this moral issue to me? And Dinah's response is, you're the person who matters the most. You're the person doing the work. You're the little person who every day makes a choice when you could be making a different choice. And that, you know, plays out in the novel between them quite a bit.
Laura, thanks so much for being here today to talk about the meaning of fear. We're on the edge of things now, so we'll have to say goodbye for now. But I'm so glad. Come back anytime. It's been so lovely to talk with you.
Thank you so much, T. This has been a pleasure. Thank you for such great questions and for bringing my novel to your listeners. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thanks for writing it.
Thank you.
Today on Living Writers, Laura Hultin Thomas, The Meaning of Fear, the debut novel of Laura's out with Regal House Publishing. Thanks again to Reverend Andrew for engineering today, to Jason Adam Voss for pulling the songs for us, and for updating the Living Writers website. Jason, you're a hero. And thanks to my mom for listening. And thanks also to all of you out there for listening. Take good care out there. Until next time.
I can only hear myself. Okay, yeah, I can hear myself. I can't hear you though.